Hey, Lulu here. Whether we are romping through science, music, politics, technology, or feelings, we seek to leave you seeing the world anew. Radiolab adventures right on the edge of what we think we know, wherever you get podcasts.
Thanks for downloading this podcast from The Takeaway. I'm John Huckenberry, and if you're ready, we'll begin. This is The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry with your weather report for Lima, Peru, where it is a balmy 72 degrees Fahrenheit in Lima all week. Air pollution index in the moderate range in this city, down in a valley that the World Health Organization claims typically has the worst air in Latin America. Why am I talking about Lima? Well, there's a climate change conference convening down there, and one can only hope that a break in the levels of poisonous pollutants in Lima's air and blue skies won't sap the urgency out of the climate conference convening here all week. More about that in a moment. We will explore global inequality as well and the impacts of climate change and the extreme economic inequality between rich and poor, now starring, it turns out, in Hollywood movies.
I'll be all around in the dark. I'll be everywhere, wherever you can look. Wherever there's a fight so hungry people can eat, I'll be there. Wherever there's a cop beating up a guy, I'll be there. I'll be in the way guys yell when they're mad. I'll be in the way kids laugh when they're hungry and they know supper's ready. And when the people are eating the stuff they raise and living in the houses they build, I'll be there, too.
Giving me goosebumps. Henry Fonda. Of course, poverty and wealth, extreme poverty and extreme wealth, have always been big stars in Hollywood movies. The Tom Joad story there, reexamined in 21st century movies. Perhaps the grapes of wrath have turned to vinegar in all this time. But let's begin in Lima, a city that posts more unhealthy days in its air quality index than nearly any other city in the Western Hemisphere. In China today, there are five cities beyond unhealthy right now and actually hazardous. That's the warning people are greeted with today. China leads the world in bad urban air. No nation even comes close besides China. India scores some very unhealthies, but China is simply festooned with air warnings. The U.S. was once the world leader in breathable pollution until the Clean Air Act gave the government tools to regulate, but toxins aren't carbon, and to deal with carbon-caused climate change and global warming will require some new tools and a renewed commitment to air quality in a different, more comprehensive way. Here to talk about that is Jody Freeman, former White House Counselor for Energy and Climate Change and now Director of Harvard's Environmental Law Program. Jody, welcome.
Hi, John. Great to be with you.
So the Clean Air Act was a real success in the United States, but I'm wondering if that approach now on carbon, and the U.S. and China, of course, have made this agreement. I'd love for you to talk about that. If it is the wrong approach in that we have this illusion that our air is all fixed, even though we're a big carbon emitter and global warming continues unabated.
Well, you're right. The Clean Air Act is the tool of choice for dealing with carbon pollution. It's got a great track record, as you pointed out. You know, the Clean Air Act is the reason we don't look like China today. We have relatively clean air despite population growth and industrial development. And what's beautiful about the Clean Air Act is Congress wrote it in a way that gives the Environmental Protection Agency flexibility to deal with new problems, new risks, new hazards, new dangers to public health and to the environment. And that is why it gives the flexibility to also regulate greenhouse gas emissions. So the president is using it very aggressively to try to deal with the problem of climate change, really unlike any other administration before him.
Now, the president is going to act aggressively and unilaterally, as you suggest. Is that possibly some of the promise that was made to China in this agreement? Because certainly China has very pragmatic and tangible reasons to act quickly on both the toxic front and the carbon front.
Right. I mean, you hit the nail on the head when you talked about the terrible air pollution problem in China. That may be driving them even more than the problem of climate change. But either way, the U.S.-China deal is really, I think, a game changer. It adds tremendous momentum to these talks in Lima. You know, the U.S. and China are the two indispensable nations on this problem. They are together, if you combine them, responsible for 40% of global emissions. So when they come forward and announce a deal that says, look, We're each committing to targets. Here's how we're going to get there. That sets the tone for the rest of the world.
Is there a strategic question here of having to proceed on both the toxic front, the particulates front that the Clean Air Act was so successful at, and also the carbon front, and that China may get to a point where they say, you know, all actually what we want to do is to just make our air look like yours and worry about the carbon stuff later. Is there a technological approach which is able to handle this comprehensively, and the Chinese can actually learn some of our lessons and do better than the United States on the carbon front?
Well, it turns out they're intertwined. Controlling conventional air pollution and toxic air pollution and actually reducing carbon emissions is all part of the same process, which is actually reducing your pollution. And if you can do that and increase your efficiency, you control everything. So it's all great, you know, if you can make progress on conventional pollution. By definition, you're probably making progress on your carbon pollution. And China can definitely learn from our technological developments. You know, part of what the president's been negotiating, really starting in the first term, was a bunch of deals and exchanges and collaborative efforts on technology sharing and learning, because that's a huge part of how you make progress on controlling these dangerous pollutants.
But don't scrubbers make power plants less efficient and actually add carbon to the atmosphere? And that you got to do something besides just scrubbing the air in power plants to make this work.
Well, the real problem is that we don't have a technology that is cheap and available and widely deployed that can capture carbon yet. We're working on it, and we have some demonstration projects for carbon capture, but it's not in widespread use. And so that technology may well develop more over the next several years. But what you really need to do is improve the efficiency of your plants, your power plants in particular, and you actually have to switch from dirty coal to cleaner natural gas and then start to deploy more renewable or cleaner energy to substitute for the dirtier fossil fuels. And that's actually what China has committed to do. It's a kind of amazing commitment they made in this deal with the U.S. to achieve 20% non-fossil fuel-based energy by 2030. That's a big commitment and a sign of what's possible.
A very upbeat-sounding Jody Freeman, former White House Counselor for Energy and Climate Change, now Director of Harvard's Environmental Law Program, talking about the Conference on Climate Change convening in Lima, Peru. Jody, thanks so much.
My pleasure.
Coming up, government agencies aren't the only institutions dealing with the aftermath of the tensions in Ferguson, Missouri. The NFL was the scene of a Ferguson protest last week on the field during a Rams game. We'll talk about that coming up. First, though, an image of the police in Ferguson that was disturbing last summer, police in military garb with military vehicles on the streets, has proved not to be disturbing enough to significantly change a policy in any way. Washington correspondent Todd Zwillick says the White House has concluded that no major changes are needed to programs that send used military equipment to local police. Todd, what's going on here?
Well, a lot of people, including members of Congress, wanted a full review of this program. It's called 1033 at the Department of Defense. And this is the program that sent $2.7 billion worth of military equipment to local law enforcement agencies over the last 5 years. Now, the White House report points out, hey, 96% of this stuff is pretty mundane. It's chairs, tables, office equipment, stuff like that, you know, regular old SUVs for driving around. But 4% of it is weapons. And that amounts to a lot. 460,000 pieces of controlled military property, Humvees, night vision, M16s, armed personnel carriers, stuff like that.
But it wasn't the issue not a percentage issue, but it's a perception issue, and that, you know, okay, fine, if there's, 50 chairs and desks in a police force from the federal government, you know, thank you very much. But if there's one armored personnel carrier on the street, it just leaves much stronger a message. I'm wondering what members of Congress think about this.
The White House has disappointed a lot of people. You're right, John, because it's not just about what weapons are out there, but how they're used. And if the community knows that if they protest, they're going to be confronted by some heavy weapons. Listen to Senator Dick Durbin. He wrote a letter last week to the Defense Department asking for a review, and he's one of the members of Congress who's very skeptical of this program. I spoke to him last night.
They've given me their side of it. Their side of it is we're facing military assault weapons, which are legal in this country, and we're facing the potential of terrorism, and we want to protect our people in uniform, as well as the communities that we are sworn to protect. So that's how they look at it. Then the other side of the equation is the image just escalates the profile of the police in these incidents, and in many ways inflames a situation which might otherwise be handled a lot more calmly.
Now, John Durbin there is talking about the police, their side of it. When bills came out saying, let's curtail this program, let's shut it down, or at least send some of these weapons back, police organizations pushed back hard. And that's the tension that Dick Durbin is talking about there. Now, a lot of people wanted a ban on this program in the big defense bill that's coming up in Congress today. And I talked to Senator Carl Levin, he's the chairman of that committee, asked him if there was ever any chance that curtailing this program was going to get in the bill. Listen.
Some places it's worked well, and some places it may not have worked well, but we want to see what the report says about how well it's worked before I reach a judgment on it. Obviously, it has served a useful purpose in places, but if it hasn't served a useful purpose in other places, then you got to weigh the pluses and the minuses.
You know, one of the new things that is come out of this conversation this week is that the president wants to spend $265 million on mandatory body cams on police. What's the chance of that happening?
Not quite. The $263 million is a total program. Only $75 million of that would be matching funds for body cameras, which means a state, a governor has to come up with the rest of the money, and you have to see if they'll do that. A lot of people are calling for those body cameras. As you know, there's a lot of data that says it tends to rein in police behavior and might tamp down confrontations with people in the streets, both in protest situations and emergency situations. The White House is on board with that, but they can't write a check. It's an ask. Congress will have to act on that, John. In the meantime, you're right. The White House has concluded here that there's no need to curtail this 1033 program. They said it should go on. They said it has been useful in some cases, but that they need better auditing, better tracking. A lot of local law enforcement agencies don't know how much they've got, and the Pentagon doesn't know how much they've sent. And that's what the White House wants to change.
Keep the weapons, add more cameras. That's the solution to the unrest that we saw in Ferguson, according to the White House. Takeaway Washington correspondent Todd Zwillick, thanks so much.
You bet, John.
You're listening to The Takeaway from WNYC and PRI Public Radio International in collaboration with The New York Times and WGBH Boston Public Radio.
Five St. Louis Rams football players made use of the national spotlight that has made the NFL the most watched television in the United States last weekend. During a game against the Oakland Raiders, they raised their arms in the hands-up, don't-shoot gesture made famous by the protests in Ferguson, Missouri. The St. Louis Police Officers Association demanded an apology and a fine, but the NFL refused, issuing a statement that read, quote, "We respect and understand the concerns of all individuals who have expressed views on this tragic situation." And that's the end of the quote. Joining us now is ESPN's Jane McManus. Hi there, Jane.
Hi, how are you doing, John?
So, great. And I'm wondering if the NFL really has understood in the last few years just how much and how rapidly it is becoming a forum for all kinds of issues on the field.
Perhaps. And sports have always been a forum. I mean, used sparingly. Definitely a forum for athletes to make money, definitely a forum for athletes to raise money for charities, and at times a forum for athletes to speak on political situations. You know, I think back to when Venus Williams wrote an op-ed in the New York Times in 2006 advocating for equal pay at Wimbledon and the French Open. And a year later, those two tournaments paid women equal prize money with men. So sometimes political speech can be very effective. And I think in this situation, the Rams players are kind of following in that tradition. And the NFL has decided not to fine them and issued a statement that I thought was pretty telling, kind of cutting both sides, you know, saying that it respected, the sides of both people in this issue. And that's something that, you know, I think trying to play it down the middle a little bit and show deference where and not issuing any kind of discipline.
And of course, in some issues, you can't really play it down the middle. The domestic violence, the Ray Rice case, which is all over the news this week because of the court decision. And now Rice is attempting to resurrect his reputation. At the meantime, when you're watching NFL games, there are constant messages, you know, public service announcements about domestic violence. The NFL has certainly completely changed the national conversation on this issue.
That's absolutely true. And this was kind of an issue that it was pulled into, not one that it accepted willingly because of the Ray Rice situation. But I think the NFL has done a lot to try to take control of this idea that they have responsibility in this area. They've been doing some training with each team. They have an hour program now that is being launched. It's going out to each team. Over half of the teams have sat through this presentation. And the presentation is just the beginning. It goes over a lot of different things: sexual assault, it goes over domestic violence and child abuse, and it also goes over the idea of consent. What is consent? You know, how do you know you have it? Making sure that you're in a situation where both adults are consenting in the situation. This is new territory for the NFL. It's certainly in a very touchy subject, right? I mean, there are a lot of players who may look at this as an invasion into their privacy. But at the same time, the NFL has taken this issue and is doing their best to educate their players and the public.
There are a lot of fans who may view this just as a public relations gesture, but in fact, because of the influence of the NFL and its just sheer size, it will undoubtedly become a template for other corporations dealing with this kind of thing. The policies that the NFL adopts will be lessons that are taken up by other institutions in the United States, unquestionably.
Oh, absolutely. And high school coaches are going to be going to the league headquarters to talk about this very issue, how they can talk to their own teams at the high school level about it. And certainly colleges are going to be part of that, too. You're exactly right. This could be a template. And in some ways, it's a more palatable message coming from the NFL than it would be coming from another group, because of the NFL's place in the culture, and also because the NFL is a group of men. And the NFL can deliver that message in a way that other men and boys can maybe listen.
So I ask again, indeed, does the NFL really understand its special standing, and does professional sports in general understand that? In the LA Clippers case, you saw a racial question that really underscored the difference between the race on the playing court and the race in the management offices at the LA Clippers. In the case of the St. Louis Rams, the police association and the cops in St. Louis might be a different constituency than the fan base of the LA Rams and even the players on the field. So, again, the issue of race comes up in an unexpected and pretty interesting way. Is the NFL prepared for that?
Well, I think that part of the way that we know the NFL is thinking about this is in the statement that it issued, because it didn't discipline these players. And I think if you look at the optics of that, had a league that's primarily run by white men disciplined a group of black players for making a statement in solidarity with the local community over an issue that is very racially charged, I think that would have looked terrible. And I think that if you see what happened in the NBA with the Donald Sterling situation, that league certainly realized that there is nothing more toxic than the appearance of racism or racism in the ownership group. So I think that the NFL here perhaps learned a lesson from the NBA when it came to that Sterling situation. And that may be why, in part, they're trading these Rams a little bit differently.
The NFL is the new Congress, the place where debates are really played out in public. That's certainly what we're seeing. Jane, thanks so much.
Anytime.
Jane McManus, a reporter for ESPN. So the haves and the have-nots coming to a theater near you. Movies take on income inequality. We're going to talk about that later this hour. Part of our week-long discussion of how we should deal with the planet's new gilded age.
Verna, and I'm calling from Ocean View, Hawaii. And I think our only hope is to separate political office from wealth, and especially ties to corporate wealth. Western Europe figured this out a long time ago. You set campaign funding amounts by the government, and everyone gets the same amount.
Hey, this is Chris from San Antonio, Texas. Making rich people richer is doing nothing for the middle class, and redistributing wealth, quite honestly, is the only answer. That's why we have a progressive tax system.
Tria from St. Louis. I believe that we can improve everyone's situation by investing in education, in apprenticeship programs, in various ways to improve our workforce and to improve the quality of life of the middle class.
Which class are you in? Middle class? Are you one of the haves, the have-nots? Are you one of the super rich? There's a growing concern in the United States that the income inequality is dividing our society altogether. It's showing up in the movies. We'll talk about that later with Rafer Guzman, but it's our subject all week long on The Takeaway, how to deal with the Gilded Age in America and around the world. Call us at 877-8-MY-TAKE or follow us on Twitter, at The Takeaway, all one word, at The Takeaway.
When things are out of your hand, when there's nothing you can do, or if you've done all that you could do, where do you turn? Well, I turn to my faith.
Some advice from Pastor Keith Miller about faith when times get tough. And times have been tough for Pastor Miller recently. He's been having to pastor himself a little more than usual these days as he watches his 28-year-old daughter, Crystal Miller, deal with breast cancer. Listening and learning and sharing.
You know, it's not unique to anyone. I think a lot of people go through the same thing. And it's very important that people know that they're not alone, that there are others out there that may not have had the same experience, but they understand.
Keith Miller and his breast cancer survivor daughter, Crystal, also have with them the community of listeners who have followed our series, Under Her Skin, three African-American women chronicling their experience with breast cancer for much of this year. In Crystal's case, this is a journey along with her dad, who agreed to make an audio journal of his experience. Keith Miller and Crystal were in our studio recently looking forward to a milestone. Not Christmas, but a year of being cancer-free, something Crystal and her dad haven't felt since last holiday season.
2 days before Christmas, it was very heartbreaking. And you want to be there to support your child. And you try not to show any weakness because you want to be strong. But when you have those moments and you're alone, the tears do flow, you know.
Now, is that weakness, Crystal?
No.
The tears flowing?
No, I think it's human. I think it's love, that he cares so much about me, that he didn't want to see me have to go through this. So I don't see it as a weakness at all.
And what did you make of her wanting to share this whole story with the entire universe here?
You know, being a pastor, I believe that when we experience things in life, that there's a big picture. Even though we're knocked down, sometimes we do get up. And because we're able to get up, we're able to help those who have faced similar situations. And sometimes that can be our calling in life, to be able to share our experiences with others so others may be able to see their way through a situation.
So the preacher's daughter becomes a preacher. That's what this is about here.
Yeah, I think it's great to be able to share your testimony. And I think it was great to actually do it while I was going through, as well as just not the end, because, you know, it's easy after everything's said and done to be like, yeah, I did it, you could do it too, da, 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 da. But to actually see somebody going through and saying, I'm doing it, and showing them that it can be done, I think that was important. A lot of times we go through life and we think everything's about us, and really it's not. You know, it's about other people, helping other people. And I think I've learned that.
Yes.
And what's the status medically, without getting into too many details?
I'm cancer-free, and I'm almost finished with treatment. I have two more infusions to go, and I will be done December 19th. So I'm very happy. Very happy to say I'm cancer-free.
Now, are you happy? Are you lucky? Are you blessed?
Yeah, I definitely don't believe in luck. I saw this day. Sometimes it was difficult to see, but I saw this day coming where I was going to be cancer-free, and I knew it would I believed it would happen.
So, you know, cancer's everybody's, you know, top 10 fear.
Yes.
Right, Keith?
You're right.
But a parent's number one fear is what?
Oh, boy. No one wants to see their child suffering. And I think there's a fear that you may lose your child. Just those thoughts when you love your family, those thoughts that go through your mind, you know, even being a pastor, you know, you're still human. And it's one of those things where you have to have faith in believing and trusting that God will bring you through. And I've always raised my children to believe that whatever they face or whatever they go through, they can overcome it.
Mm-hmm. Worst moment for you watching what Crystal was going through?
Well, she had such beautiful hair, and just slowly seeing that, you know, the hair, and just sitting in a room and with the treatments, the chemo. I mean, all of it. It was a very difficult process, you know, but, you know, I was there to support my daughter, and I really believed that God would heal her.
And hair, you know, grows back.
You're
a little bald there, a little too under his teeth, right?
Just
right.
A little bit.
Yeah, you're surviving. You're definitely surviving. Yeah.
Yes.
What did you think when he started to join our audio diary project?
Oh, well, when I heard it, I didn't hear it prior to it airing, and it was very emotional for me because, you know, that's my father, and I don't see him cry or anything like that. He's the head of the household and strong and stuff like that. So it was difficult for me to hear him going through that because, you know, I didn't miss a night of sleep during this. I just didn't realize that he was going through that hard of a time. And I do think it was more difficult for my parents to watch me and stuff like that. And I was far away. You know, they weren't here with me every second. But I will say, like, the day that I was diagnosed, I remember going downstairs to talk to you, just like me and you, and you said, now is the time to put your faith to work. So I think he gave me really good words of wisdom and how to be grateful, you know, because it could be worse. I remember him saying that too. So I think the things that he told me in the beginning, the day of my diagnosis, is really what got me through my treatment, my perspective on things, and it really got me through. So,
what was the first thing you said to him after you heard just how tough this had all been for him in that little diary piece?
Well, I was proud of him, you know, to voice it, because I think it's important that he put that out there so other people, whether it's fathers, brothers, that they can relate to it and know that what they're feeling is not, you know, abnormal. Sometimes people just want to get through this and move on with life and act like nothing happened, but I think he made his mark. I think it was very selfless of him.
Well, thank you.
28-year-old Crystal Miller has been sharing her story of breast cancer with the Takeaways Under Her Skin. I sat down with Crystal and her father, Keith Miller, and to hear more from Crystal or the other women of our series, visit thetakeaway.org and click Under Her Skin in the upper right-hand corner of the page. Coming up, stories about income inequality in the movies, but they don't have to be fiction.
John, I'm calling from down in Florida. For 55 years, I barely fed my family and gave them clothes and got by. And the last 5 years, I stumbled on something where I've made a lot more money. But now I'm being taxed at that, and it's not fair. I mean, it's not like I've inherited it from my parents. I made it after 55 years of hard work.
8778-MY-TAKE is our number. Much more at thetakeaway.org.
Support for The Takeaway comes from Lumosity, introducing a 10-minute fit test to challenge memory, attention, and problem-solving. With brain games to calculate baseline scores and build a personalized brain training program, performance can be compared to global averages. Learn more at Lumosity.com.
Since we were talking about climate change at the beginning of this hour, you know, environmental apocalypse makes a good starting point for a lot of disaster movies. Try this one. The world's climate goes haywire. The heat destroys everything. And then the atmosphere is fogged to the point that the sun is blocked, turning the earth into an uninhabitable ice palace. No, not the Disney dream of Frozen. It's a dead world where, in a kind of Noah's Ark of humanity, people are put on a train that constantly runs. It's the only place anyone can survive. The train is run by a dictatorial authority. The whole thing is completely ridiculous, except that everyone can relate to one thing. Some people ride in first class in luxury. Most people ride in the back in squalor. Film critic Rafer Guzman and co-host of the Movie Date podcast says the severe income inequality right now in the world is making a lot of dystopian movies oddly plausible. It's exactly what turns the movie Snowpiercer from an unwatchable, ugly fantasy into a politically charged parable.
In that movie, you've got Chris Evans, who's best known as Captain America. He plays the leader of a rebellion, and he's in steerage with the rest of the underclass, and they're going to try and storm their way from the back of the train to the front of the train and find the guy who's driving this train. And all these guys are in the back eating this horrible food. They're punished. They're brutalized.
You people who would I know for the benevolent Wilford would have frozen solid 18 years ago all today. You scum. Precisely 74% of you shall die.
And I think that movie is really one of the most kind of literal analogies or metaphors of this revolution that I've seen.
What about the film Anarchy?
The Purge, Anarchy, it's a sequel to a movie called The Purge that came out, I think it was last year. So in this film, the basic premise is very simple. Again, in the near future, the government has set up this idea where one night each year, all crime is legal. You can murder, you can rape, you can torture, you can pillage, you can do whatever you like. All crime is legal for one night per year.
You, what was that army doing in your building? Why were they after you? Why would they after you?
I don't know.
Why are you in the streets?
Our car just broke down.
We're not
our car broke
purge.
Down.
We don't want to hurt anybody.
Are you armed?
No.
Well, what about you? What were you doing outside?
The first film, which starred Ethan Hawke, kind of hinted at the idea that maybe what happens in a situation like this is that the rich benefit because they can afford nice security systems and giant metal shutters and such to keep themselves safe, whereas the poor are the ones who are dying out in the streets. And this movie, this sequel, really drives this message home. That income inequality message is really out front and center. You see the wealthy people taking advantage of this. You see poor people selling themselves as purge victims to wealthy families who can get their bloodlust out in a safe way. The money then goes to the poor family. All these really gruesome scenes in the movie. I was one of the few critics that actually liked the movie. I think most people found it a little heavy-handed. But this was the first movie I've seen in many, many years where you've got, in a modern-day setting, a poor, largely black underclass rising up and violently, bloodily killing the rich white elite. I found that really shocking to see in a Hollywood film.
Elysium. Now, I didn't see this movie. I certainly saw the trailers. It seemed like kind of WALL-E, although not animated. what did this say to you?
Well, this was from the guy who did District 9.
Which I love.
I love District 9 as well, yeah. Which was also a political allegory about apartheid. And here, I think they're tackling the issue of healthcare and immigration. The world has basically become a giant Mexico. The dominant language is Spanish. Most people, aside from Matt Damon, the star, appear to be of Mexican descent, Hispanic descent of some kind. And they are down in this giant slum while there's a space station twirling up in the sky called Elysium, where the rich, led by Jodie Foster, are living in this kind of Malibu / Hamptons fantasy land. They've got plenty of food and resources, and what they have are these futuristic MRI machines that can cure basically anything. They can cure cancer and polio and a broken leg and what have you.
Hello. Before we start, I'd just like to explain...
Max DaCosta, violation of Penal Code 2219, today at bus stop 34B.
Yes, that's exactly what I wanted to talk to you about. You see, I believe there's been a misunderstanding.
Immediate extension of parole by a further 8 months.
Wait, what? No, I can explain.
Stop talking. Elevation in heart rate detected. Would you like a pill?
No.
Would you like to talk to a human?
And this movie, sort of the first kind of sci-fi movie about healthcare that I can think of, is Matt Damon trying to storm that space station, trying to storm Elysium and open the floodgates and give not just naturalized citizenship, but free healthcare for all, which I thought was perhaps not terribly realistic, but kind of funny and kind of interesting.
Hunger Games, of course, takes this very, very literally. I'm less interested in the movie and more interested in what it does to young people. This is a fable. This is a mythology that is very much tied up with the people coming of age right now.
Yeah, I think that's an interesting one because, you know, when you're a teenager, it's always fun to rebel. I grew up in the 80s when there wasn't even that much to rebel about, really, but I found something. And I think you kind of get that a little bit in The Hunger Games. But I do think that one reason it's resonated with audiences beyond just the teens is, again, this kind of this question of the elite and the fun of seeing this weird kind of decadent elite that live in the capital city of Panem, which is the fictional country in which it's set. You know, once you get away from Jennifer Lawrence, you know, she's, again, part of the underclass. Once you get away from her and you see how the other half lives, they're all in these kind of decadent, weird costumes. They look a little bit like Marie Antoinette or, you know, combined with Mick Jagger or something. It's like Versailles and Studio 54 all together in one.
Celebrity becomes a metaphor for excess and economic inequality.
Exactly, exactly. And it feeds into, I think, our fantasies about, our fantasy slash nightmare about how the other half lives, that this is what they're blowing all of our money on.
So how does this movie compare to the movies of the 30s and 40s? You've got, you know, It's a Wonderful Life. You have a lot of movies about the Depression, The Grapes of Wrath, for instance, which mm-hmm. was almost a documentary.
Right.
Very much income inequality was the theme back then, but this feels very different from back then.
That's true. I think those movies, at least those two that you mentioned, both very hopeful, and there's always those movies have a real sense of specifically the American spirit and not a fictional futuristic dystopia or some kind of fantasy country. Those movies were still really talking about America, and they struck this note of hope that you could change. Remember the closing speech of Grapes of Wrath? You know, it's essentially a political, it's a stump speech, really.
Wherever there's a fight so hungry people can eat, I'll be there. Wherever there's a cop beating up a guy, I'll be there. I'll be in the way guys yell when they're mad. I'll be in the way kids laugh when they're hungry and they know supper's ready.
I'll be out there, Ma.
Exactly.
I remember it.
Yeah, of course. Yeah. I don't know if I want to say that hope is gone, but I feel like these movies are certainly questioning that, and they're certainly questioning this idea of what happened, or at least what's happening to the American dream.
Well, let's hope the message of the films can be a learning of lessons as opposed to a yearning for the apocalypse.
Yes. Let's hope there's no reign of terror coming.
All right. Rafer Guzman, film critic for Newsday and co-host of the Movie Day podcast. Thanks so much.
Thanks, John.
Rafer, our very own Robespierre of the movies. That's our show today. I'll be there, Ma. Wherever the kids need food. I got to go home and cook it tonight. Give us your review on anything on the program at 877-8-MY-TAKE. Thanks so much for listening. I'm John Hockenberry. This is The Takeaway.
Support for The Takeaway comes from the Henry Luce Foundation for increased understanding of East and Southeast Asia, and the Rockefeller Foundation, whose transportation initiative is promoting equitable and sustainable developments in communities across the country.
PRI, Public Radio International.